Good evening, everyone. I'm Julie Jeezy, and this is Family Matters, of course. My co-host, Judge Michelle Arantz, is here. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Jill. How are you doing? You had an eventful day, didn't you?
You know, I have had a big day today, and I have to tell you, a girlfriend that you know, Carol Gregitsky, got married today at the courthouse, so I was there for that. It was a 2.5 minute ceremony in a courtroom where I spent I don't know how many years in adversarial court, so it was sort of really bittersweet for me.
Wow, I didn't realize that. I was actually talking about the other thing.
I'm getting there.
Oh, all right.
So right after that, I ran over to the Capitol, and a dear friend, Representative Jill Tracy, who is a downstate state representative from Illinois, sponsored a House resolution, House Resolution Number 0724, and it will proclaim Parental Alienation Awareness Month in the state of Illinois, which has never been done in the United States. They're working on it in Pennsylvania and Texas right now. So I'm excited about that. But it was interesting to me, Michelle, because I testified before this committee of legislators, grew up with legislators. My father was a legislator for many years and know some of them. And I sat there and told them who I was and what I did. And then I said, but by the way, I want to let you know, because parental alienation knows no economic, social, or educational boundaries, I also am an alienated mother of 4 children. And it was so quiet before that happened, but it was a collective, you know, just taking their breath away, because I think they didn't expect me to say that. And as soon as I was done testifying, the chairman of the committee said, I would like leave to pass this bill. And everybody said, leave. And we didn't even have a vote. It was just leave. And we were done. And it was out of there. And so it'll be on the House floor next week. And hopefully we'll know then whether or not we have the month in Illinois. So it's good.
Which would mean you could do what? Like rallies and
yeah,
seminars? And like, how would that work?
But you should know that Parental Alienation Awareness Day globally is April 25th. So that is a real milestone in the parental alienation arena. I thought you would know that. I thought you had off that day. And
yeah. Right. Yeah. Boy, you talk about wishful thinking.
Yeah. So what have you been doing? Tell me.
What have I been doing?
How about that little thing called a workbook? Want to talk about that a minute?
Little bit. What about that little thing?
Little thing
that
yeah.
we spent a year on. Jill and I have created, and for everybody listening, you may know this, you may not know this, but we've created Parental Alienation 911 Workbook. And we, as far as we can tell, we tried to fill a gap that was a need, which is people who are being destroyed by parental alienation need to understand not only all of the nuances of alienating behavior and how it's affecting their children, but how to rescue their own souls and their emotional life so that they can be the children that they're, be the parents that their children want to come home to. So it's a workbook, and it's very reflective, and it gives lots of tools, and I give lots of tools from the court about how to present in court, how to get your case in order, things to give your lawyer. So, you know, when you're in small towns and you don't have lawyers who are sophisticated in this field, you can help them, because sometimes you're going to have to.
Right.
So it's online. And Jill, you want to give the specifics as long as we're talking
sure,
about it?
Sure. It's www.parentalalienation911.net. And it is a downloadable workbook, so you can have it right now. It's interesting, and they are selling like hotcakes, and we are so glad that the information that we have assembled, that we've learned, that we witnessed is in one document and can be disseminated all over the place, all over the world. I mean, we've sold in Stockholm and Switzerland and Australia, and so we're all over the place.
Yes, so there you go. But
so there you go.
We want to let everybody know, before we introduce our guest, Dr. Rebecca Bailey, we want to tell our listeners that in addition to our emphasis has always been parental alienation, and it will remain to be so. But we're branching out into more different kinds of parenting problems and parenting skills and tips. And we're going to, it's not just parental alienation. We want to talk about visitation interference, ideas for how to better help your children going through a divorce. So in that vein, we always want to educate you. We want to give you new ideas. We want to give you the counterintuitive skills. Jill's going to introduce our guest.
I am. You know, I've talked to Rebecca, Dr. Rebecca Bailey, many, many times on the phone, and I feel as if I know her, that I've known her for a very long time. We've seen each other on Skype, but that's, we've never actually sat down across from each other. But I want to tell you a little bit about Rebecca. Other than that, she is my friend, and I respect the work that she does. She has a practice called Transitioning Families in California. It encompasses family and individual counseling, as well as something that is so important in parental alienation and many other aspects of divorce reunification programs. She has parenting classes and supervised visitation services. She has incorporated her clinical experience with her longstanding interest in animal therapy and the equine-assisted growth and learning programs, which I think is fantastic because I love horses and so does she. I started a therapeutic riding program here in Illinois for children with disabilities, so it's exciting that she's doing sort of the same thing, and we're going to hear about that. She has a doctorate degree from the Wright Institute in Berkeley, California. She focuses in high-conflict familial situations and parent coordination from a developmental perspective. She's a former director of the Sonoma Police Department's Youth and Family Services Program and was a therapist educator for programs at the Marin County DUI program. She continues to work with a variety of state and national organizations, such as the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, which is so incredibly important. And she served as a special master and expert witness in cases where parental alienation or estrangement is an issue. My goodness, Rebecca, you've been busy.
I have been. I have. And
welcome.
I'm glad you're calling me Rebecca.
Why?
Let's keep with the Rebecca and dispense of the doctor.
Ah, as opposed to Dr. Bailey.
Yes, that never works. It only works in the courtroom.
Okay. Well, you have so many interesting things to talk about. And as Michelle said, we're trying to, you know, expand our sort of focus on family matters. And while reunification, which we'll talk about in a little while, is really, really important to alienating families, if you can ever get a judge to order that in an alienation case, it's so important. So we definitely want to talk about that. But what would you say, Rebecca, you're doing now? What is the real, what percentage of your cases are the highest at this point?
I think I'm still pretty up there with the high-conflict divorce, or what I like to call the multiple case files, where as a judge you're aware of the ones, Michelle, when the multiple case files are over there and you see it and you've seen the same families over and over again. So that tends to be a decent chunk of the cases I see, but I also do non-familial and familial abduction work, and kind of have coined a new term for myself that I'm a connection facilitator.
That's good.
I like
so,
it.
And I'm actually in the process. I've finally accepted an intern who I'm working with, who's fabulous, and I'm telling her I'm going to get her a PhD in connection facilitation.
Do you think it could become a subspecialty?
I think it ought to become a subspecialty. I don't know if it could, but stemming off from reunification or reintegration, I think that it would be a fabulous focus for a lot of therapists to pay more attention with too.
With you, because one of my pet projects in my mind, and I'm wanting to coordinate with therapists, is not just the pain of divorce, not just the pain of being estranged from your children, because there are therapists, but there's almost no therapists who do anything about the terror of the divorcing process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
you know, giving a deposition and being told you're a bad parent, what that feels like. People don't get over this. What it feels like to see your spouse in court behind enemy lines and for the first time after 6 months. People don't get over these things. I'd like to see that, and that goes along with what you're saying, breaking down of connection.
But, Rebecca, how do you do that? I mean, you obviously have created this niche for yourself. When you were in school, did you even think about honing your skills into this subset of therapy?
I on one level, yes. I consider myself a bit of a poster child for high-conflict divorces, having been in the midst of a very nasty one when I was 11 back in Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
and was up close and personal to what happens when there's tremendous amounts of money being thrown around on both sides and the kids are caught in the middle. So part of me always had an interest in it. In graduate school, I also had a tremendous interest in innovative methods of how do you get people to connect. I have great respect for my field, but I also think it's over-intellectualized, some of the work people do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always had an inkling that I was going to do something different than a lot of my peers.
Yeah.
Well, so what would you say to people? I mean, because I've heard before from some therapists, well, what do you want from us? We didn't learn how to deal with this. Speaking of parental alienation, we didn't learn how to deal with this in school. We didn't really learn how to talk about children or talk to children. And that probably the most in-depth that they got with children was the Anna Freud, you know, play therapy model, which Dr. Craig Childress down in Pasadena, who deals with alienated children all the time, says does nothing for
yep.
alienated children. So how do you get these people who are coming fresh out of school to understand, because they may be presented with these kinds of cases, how do you get them to understand what the correct protocol is, or do they just refer off to somebody like you?
I think it's beginning to be a little bit more mainstream. I'm out in California. I'm beginning to see the word parental alienation spelled out more in some of the court documents. I have mixed feelings about how it's being used. It seems to be being bantered around a little bit by whatever attorney thinks of it first sometimes. But roundabout way of answering your question, I think as more people in the field, such as myself, continue to speak out loud and try to educate other people. I've actually just coming out with a self-published manual that I'm going to have available that is primarily for horse people using horse work for this field, but it's intended to encourage people to think out of the box and take a focus off themselves, therapists, off their role with the kids, and look at more how can they get themselves out of a job as they facilitate the communication. So I think it's more shows like yours, education, people not being afraid to try things a little bit different in
mm-hmm.
cases. I use food. We have the luxury of having a professional chef that some of our best connection facilitations have happened with families cooking together. And one particularly wonderful one was a family that hadn't been together in 5 years. And the chef had the mother on one side of the kitchen chopping and the father on the other side. And
mm-hmm.
it worked out, and then everybody, you know, it sounds lovely, but everybody was able to sit down and have a meal together. Now, in the extreme alienation, we know that that would be a dangerous thing, particularly with knives in the kitchen.
Well, I was going to say, what did you do, not sharpen the knives or put little rubber tips on them?
Yeah, we do a rigorous pre-screening. But you know, if the attorneys that had originally referred that case my way, if I had told them that that was going to happen, they would have told me no way.
Well, tell us a little bit about that. And what I mean by that is, so could you paint the picture a little bit about how they resisted and what moment did it start to break down and how that, what your game plan is?
Well, I think, to be honest, my role and reputation out in the area that I work in was always sort of, I used to call it the end of the line cases, where they would send me, again, the multiple case file cases my way. And one particularly enlightened judge was aware of some of the work that I did, particularly beginning back with a very, very difficult, severe alienation case that I was working on. So I started to develop a reputation sort of for, well, we don't know what else to do with this case. Let's send it to Rebecca.
Uh-huh.
And once I began to do that, once I got that reputation with some of these cases, I would think, well, I have nothing else to lose. Everything else has been tried. Why don't we try something different? And so I was able to build a very specialized, very small facility with an office. It has within a shouting distance an arena, and then there's a kitchen very close as well. And so the main thing was getting these guys off and out of the office and not just sitting in there and having the parent, particularly the least favorite parent or whatever we want to call them, sitting there with an angry child. Again, we're talking more the mild to mid alienation cases.
Okay.
But I've also been able to, and I've learned from the cases that I've worked with, and in some cases a very intensive workshop for 3 or 4 days where the focus is truly, truly on the reconnection can be fabulous.
But what happened in the cooking situation when they started to soften to each other?
Well, it was interesting because what I was doing was meeting with the children while the chef had the two parents, and then the two parents came in here and the children went back in there. And so I deliberately didn't sit there while the parents were in there because I felt that by giving them a focused activity without feeling like they were being scrutinized by a psychologist was probably wise. My understanding is it actually went well, and what the chef has reported to me, and I've actually seen myself, sometimes old memories will pop up, a pleasant memory. I suppose it could go the opposite way, but another example is a young boy that I was working with who had not seen his father, and it was certainly there was some estrangement there. I couldn't think of a positive thing to say about his father until one day he was doing a cooking class with his brother, and I happened to ask him if he could remember anything about his father's cooking, and he said he made the most amazing spaghetti sauce. This all sounds very unbelievable, but 3 weeks later the father was in the kitchen making the spaghetti sauce with the kids. So it's, again, it's just about engineering a little bit of a connection.
Would you do that in alienation cases? I was just going to say, because if the child warms up to the target parent right in front of the alienating parent, that doesn't seem like that could happen.
No, and I think that you have to, for the second case that I spoke of, the mother was not there. So you're absolutely right. Also, it's very important and it's very tricky, and sometimes I'm not quite sure how to explain to other people to do it, but to develop an alliance on some level with both parents. I come into a lot of these cases where I'm trying to facilitate the communication with the attitude that both parents have a lot to learn and they're in a position where they're forced that they have to learn something. And that's been the nice thing, since judges have been putting sanctions in more and been a little bit more aware of the whole issue of parental alienation. Because when there's a little pressure on that alienating parent, they tend to do a little bit more positive work.
Rebecca, how did you develop the cooking therapy? I mean, obviously food is comfort, food is kitchen is where I remember my family sitting for a couple of hours every night talking and eating, and it was a long, drawn-out process that I remember very fondly, which I think people don't do anymore. I think there's too many things going on in kids' lives for them to be able to even sit down at dinner. If they're lucky, they get a Subway in the back of the van. You know, so how did you come up with this great idea to pair cooking with this therapy for reunification?
Well, I think it's always been an important piece in my life, to not the cooking, because ironically I don't like to cook, but I love food. And the idea of breaking bread together is, as we know, goes back in history. When it really came into the forefront was in working with a particular case where there had really been a long period of disconnection in the family, and just beginning with even presenting nurturing food became such a big piece of the work that then from there it made such sense to apply that to the other work, but to the alienation work or the high conflict divorce work. But the real answer is looking for any opportunity to create an environment or a moment where a positive connection can be facilitated. So even if it's, you know, sometimes even going in the backyard and throwing the ball with the dog, and a parent and a child is in a supervised visitation, in my mind, can be extremely therapeutic. Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say, unless there's severe cases, I don't like supervised visitation. It's really, it's the court saying that parent is dangerous. I mean, it's, and there's no, you can't really connect. But as you were speaking, and I was thinking about a cooking supervised visit, wouldn't seem like a supervised visit. What a great way to be interactive.
And, you know, I have a certain segment of folks that maybe I don't come at it with this idea, but you're never, in some so-called false allegation cases, there's times that I'm never really sure. And if there's a positive where these kids do want to have a contact with a parent, sometimes it's not, this is going to sound very controversial, but it's not necessarily safe for the parent to be alone with the child either, because it's only a matter of seconds that another allegation is going to be made.
Right.
That's where the supervised visitation, I don't care for them either, because I think that frequently they're glorified babysitting services, but on my to-do list is to challenge that notion in a big way, and to really encourage the facilitation of supervised visitation so it's a therapeutic opportunity. There is no reason you have to sit in a room and watch a parent and child play, and there's no reason it has to be presented to the child like, you have to be with this parent for because the court doesn't trust your parent. I mean, in some cases, we know some parents are not safe. But in the cases where there's huge areas of gray, the opportunity to use those supervised visitations as a therapeutic session is right. You just have to be careful that you don't overanalyze it. You have to be careful to help them steer out of the big potholes. And it does, again, we go back to that word, you know, the PhD in communication facilitation. You've really got to help that.
All right, I want to ask you something, and I can guarantee you that domestic relations judges and most lawyers don't know what a supervised visitation is supposed to be like.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask you this because I would imagine it's sitting in a room looking at each other with somebody looking at them. Could you tell us what is traditionally, and give us some ideas of how, if you're addressing me, I might micromanage the visits so they're better?
Okay. There's two pieces. One is that I'm sort of, when I've looked into what are guidelines for supervised visitation from state to state, they do seem to differ. Traditionally, in our area, frequently they are done in a center, and the child and the parent play together, and the supervisor sits there and takes notes and tries to avoid any difficult subjects that come up. What I would say, and I do believe this is beginning to be a little bit more recognized, is get people outside, move them, have them... I will have certain parents bring something to eat for the child. there's a lot of times in supervised visitations, there's rules of no, of bringing no food, no presents for the child. I'm sorry, I'm getting distracted by the dogs. you need to create a warm, loving, warm environment. You need to help sometimes these parents and these kids who have no idea how to connect. They have no idea sometimes even what they're doing in the situation. You have to encourage an environment where they feel comfortable, safe. One of my supervised visitations, we start with hot potato. We throw a potato to each other and, you know, the family and myself, and actually the intern was with us last time, had to just come up with one thing that had been really tough that week, you know, and whoever caught the potato had to say it. And it really wasn't meant to be a deep therapeutic intervention. It was just to break the ice.
Well, you're talking about therapeutic supervised. The majority of supervised are with supervising agencies, not
right.
necessarily therapeutic.
But should they not be? I mean, I guess the word therapeutic is what scares people. But should they not be more interactive? The majority, you're right, are agencies. And, I question, at least in our area, these folks are doing good work, but some of the training that these supervisors have is very substandard, with no disrespect meant towards supervised visitation folks. But they are told to sit there and take notes and be very quiet and stay out of the parent-child interaction, which is so awkward. So
yeah.
To me, you have to loosen up or have some art supplies out. You know, as I said, you know, bring a picnic lunch. Do something besides just have somebody sitting there. I don't know about you guys, but I would find it extremely awkward to sit in a room with somebody taking notes.
I'm going to order that.
Yeah.
Art supplies, picnic, anything else?
Art supplies, picnics, games, the hot potato thing. You don't even have to do that therapeutically. It can just be what's the best thing that happened this week. You know, I love photos, and I know that sometimes in the very high conflict cases that if the kid comes into the session, and I've had a few of these myself where they do not, and this is therapeutic, but I'm trying to take my hat off on that, where they don't want to talk at all to the parent. Well, I am of the belief, and I know there's some therapists that disagree, that the parent can bring in pictures and show the supervisor. You know, this is your aunt, this is his aunt so-and-so doing such and such. I think that it shouldn't be such a sterile environment.
I guess, Rebecca, though, they have to really care about what they're doing. And I think if you're looking at, you know, some of the people that I'm looking at in the state of Illinois that are, you know, sitting through a supervised visit and watching these kids play with the parent, they don't care if they're there or not. So you really have to be invested in a positive outcome, and I think that would be such a stretch for so many, you know, not just in Illinois, but all over the country.
I think so, too, unless you can convince people of the absolute importance of providing an opportunity for that relationship, for that connection. I keep saying that word over and over again, but I agree. These guys, you know, a lot of people are not particularly pleased with their job, and they don't really want to be there. But I don't know. My experience with a lot of the supervisors in our area have been actually the opposite. That on some levels, they're overinvested, and I want to be careful here, but it's a different perspective than what you're saying. And I do think if you could sell it as a useful, instead of just a babysitting service, I think you might see a better outcome.
So maybe you put together some kind of program that can be implemented nationwide for these people to be trained in exactly what you're talking about. I mean, they were trained to do what they do.
Exactly.
And so, you know, seemingly it would be easy to just say, do these five things.
Yeah. I think so, and I think, you know, I also want to be clear that I actually think some of the best learning my children had would be with great babysitters And so when I say glorified babysitting, I got to say that I just look at every moment as an opportunity. And especially when it involves kids, in a blink of an eye, they're old. And so we owe, any time we put these guys in experiences with their parents where there's detention, they're dealing exactly with what you said, with all the crap they got to deal with from the court and the parents and this and that. We need to try to make it a positive experience, because why would they want to reconnect with a parent if it's like a real sterile, horrible experience?
Yeah.
Well, let's say, I'm not sure that everybody who's listening knows that you were the therapist in probably one of the great estrangement cases of all time, the J.C. Dugard case. And I know you've been talking about that a lot for a long time, but I'm going to frame the question like this. What can we learn, people who try and give advice to alienated parents, from what you learned from treating J.C. Dugard, who was taken for what, 14 years, 18 years?
Yeah. And
from her parents?
I wouldn't really classify it as an estrangement. I mean, it was a clear, straightforward abduction.
Right.
And I'm anytime I speak publicly, it's with her blessing, because her message is so important. And her message is really, which doesn't so much fit what your question is, but to just really ask yourself to care, to really pay attention to the interactions of people around you. And I think that's the strongest thing I can say. But when you ask me what I've learned, I will tell you that what I have learned, and this is probably an awful thing to say, but how much agencies and organizations and well-meaning folks, how exhausting it sometimes can be for people to have to deal with that when they're dealing with a trauma on top of things. And that's probably the most indirect, best direct answer I can give you to your question.
Well, but I mean about, let's say that we have a family where the children have not spoken to their parent in years.
Yeah.
And who fully believes that child, that the parent is evil, and it's a full-blown, successful alienation, succeeded.
Yeah.
Is there anything that we could learn about, maybe not, about deprogramming, I guess?
Well, I can, without going into any details, I can tell you that absolutely was not the case at all. There was no expectation. People do, how about this? People do what they need to do to survive. And when you believe that your very, very, very life is dependent on the person in power, you will adjust your thinking at all costs. And I guess that would be the best, if we can cross it to the field of alienation, what we can say is, if you are in the very sad position of being the least favored parent, to understand that the child on their side may very much be doing everything they can to just survive in a situation that is absolutely horrendous. Then I can add on top of that patience and compassion as a therapist for all the different perspectives is really important.
I think it's so important that you say that, Rebecca, because I talk to a lot of parents who tend to blame their children for the behavior that they're having, you know, if they're still having contact, the disrespectful behavior, the cursing, the hitting, the, you know, anything that isn't what the child was before, and then ultimately the silence. And so, you know, you have to let these people know that it is not, it's just, it's a protection mechanism by the child to try to survive in that situation.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the internal conflict, I mean, as a therapist, I can also speak to that, and you all who work in this field and are so familiar with it, the internal conflict for the child is just, boy, it's so extreme. And as much as possible, helping alleviate the pressure. As a therapist, what I frequently will do, or even in our reunification weekend, is try to give the kids some information. And often the judges, and rightfully so, will tell both parents that the subject is totally off divorce, that the parents can't talk to the child about divorce. And I concur with that 100%. But as a therapist working in reunification or with, you know, weekly sessions with these kids, sometimes I really lay the facts out as much as I can and point out, without saying this parent's good, this parent's bad, just saying, boy, this is confusing to me, and see what they say. And sometimes when the dust settles, not always, but sometimes these kids are a lot wiser than people think. And I think, you know, Amy Baker, who wrote The Ties That Bind, mm-hmm. about adult children, in her work, she does clarify, there is some discussion of how there, I think I read this, I may be reading too much into it, but that there was sometimes an awareness of the how off base the parent was, the alienating parent was,
right,
and the feeling of helplessness towards that.
Well, I would like to be able to not only understand reunification therapy, but I'd like to spend a little bit of time on it, because I can tell you that I'm in the largest unified divorce court system, family court system in the world, mm-hmm. in Cook County, and I maybe count on one hand. I've never heard anyone talk about reunification therapy until I met one of the many people through Jill, who is like the clearinghouse for all the information, and has brought them to me and educated me so that I could be a better judge in court, truthfully. Yeah. And I want to further passing it on, I need to understand what reunification therapy is, why it's different from traditional, why it's wrong in the alienation cases. I know why, but I'd like you to say, and how do you find one?
Okay, so reunification is a word that goes back, at least from my read, to the intensive foster family programs probably 30 years ago, and I'm forgetting what state it was, but that's where I first found note of reunification, which was really reconnecting children back into their family of origin. The intensive reunification programs were very effective, and, of course, funding was cut because they are more expensive. So in working with the high-conflict families, I began to use that term more and more, because what I was doing was not like the traditional therapy at all. I was much more interactive with the clients, much more directive with clients. And frequently, when I had appropriate court documents, would be doing communications with attorneys and somewhat directive with the attorneys as well. And it might be just telling them to back off for a little bit. So reunification, that's how I came in with the word reunification. I joined forces somewhat with a woman named Joanne Leipert, who was my mentor in abduction cases. She, for many years, had worked with abduction. And what she and I were both seeing were parallels in both populations. I'm not talking familial, but in stranger abductions as well. We were seeing some parallels in what was needed. So we presented at a conference in Reno at the American Family Conciliatory Courts a few years ago, but on this particular approach, I am now hearing people using the word reunification much more, and I narcissistically like to think that we are at the forefront of using it for this particular population, but that may not
right.
be true. I always find out that every great idea was already thought of by somebody else a couple weeks ago, so... So that, to answer your question, that's, in my mind, that what it is reconnecting families. I can roll into the traditional family, the traditional therapy, which often results in splintering of perspective. Unless you have a very cohesive connection with the therapist and the community working with the individual families, often the right hand can be doing something so different than the left hand. That for my liking, when I do reunifications, I like to work with the other therapists, or better yet, have myself and maybe one other person during the period of time that the work is being done.
What other therapist?
Well,
are you talking about the child? You know, usually the alienating parent will say, the child's in therapy, and the therapist said they shouldn't see mom.
Yeah, and
is that the therapist you're talking about?
Yeah, they're there many times, and frequently, gosh, it's so revealing to be on radio. I have been accused of sometimes bullying the therapist because to be kind to myself, often the child will be in the office and have a great connection with the parent, and then I'll get a call. This has happened frequently. I'll get a call from the child therapist saying, oh, my gosh, the child was so disturbed to see the parent. And I'll say, well, wait a second, that wasn't my perspective. So that hasn't happened in about a year and a half. I think people are afraid to tell me that now.
Reunification therapy challenges the child's misperceptions?
Yes, it does, but it doesn't challenge it completely. It challenges it a little bit more covertly, meaning that you don't sit there in the office and say your mother's bad or your father's bad. It's much more of, again, creating an environment there where there's a more positive connection with the other parents. In the cases of doing an intensive weekend, that's you know, you have a series of activities you do all weekend. Sometimes, in my field, I think you both are probably familiar, maybe the listeners, with the issue of what's called the critical incident.
Mm-hmm.
And the critical incident being the situation that blew up and made it worse. And I'm talking more moderate alienation here, but the critical incident being something that happened. Dad brought a girlfriend to dinner, mom brought a boyfriend, suddenly the kids, you know, are even more full of hate towards that parent. The other parent capitalizes on that experience. What we have found is once you have a little bit of an alliance that type of situation can be untangled a little bit with discussion. I have sat with a bunch of kids and untangled the critical incident to support both perspectives. And I've been effective.
So how do you find one?
How do you find a therapist?
Or how do you screen for whether a traditional therapist could adapt to these kind of skills? What are the questions?
Well, I do think that there ought to be at least some training in family therapy and some experience with family therapy. I think that being a member of ASCC, I think it is important, or at least familiar with ASCC. If a therapist doesn't know ASCC, I would be a little concerned. And
okay.
Not because I'm not doing PR for ASCC. I just think that there's a lot of good research and discussion.
You can do that, Rebecca, because
yes.
Michelle and I are presenting there in June, so that's fine.
Okay. You know, I was thinking of coming to that.
You should come.
Yeah. So, and anyways, so I do, I think that is important. I think also having somebody, even in the conversation, it's hard because if you're the alienator or the favored parent, sometimes you seek out therapists that are yes people, obviously. So when there is shared legal custody, I absolutely concur that both parents have to agree with the therapist, which can be quite difficult because sometimes the favored parent isn't going to like the choice of the least favored parent. But it's also the therapist's job to create some type of, again, connection with both parents. So if you're not doing an intensive weekend and you're doing, let's say, a 6-month reunification, where you, it's the therapist's job to somehow build a connection with both those parents. That's what I think. And I can tell you that we're pretty successful doing that. I can't say that every parent who's ever come through really likes both of likes the therapist. Both, you know, both parents like the therapist, but at least there's the feeling of being respected by both therapists, I believe.
Rebecca, you know, as I think about you, and I know you don't know probably Brian Ludmer, but Brian Ludmer is an attorney from Canada who's been on our show a couple of times, brilliant guy, and very successful at returning children to the target parent. And he is now working with lawyers all over the United States, getting them up to speed on what they need to do in a custody hearing, the questions they need to ask, the protocol they need to use, how they need to, you know, they need to deal with an alienator. And so I can see you in that same place in the therapy field. You are consulting with therapists all over the nation and globally, trying to get them up to speed on what this is. But the problem I really see is that the psychological community, the therapy community, is about 10 years behind where they need to be on this.
I agree, because they're so busy fighting over Gardner and you know, that it just bogs things down. I have found an interesting community. I'm connected with a group that does coursework. And there are some therapists that go to conventions around this organization called EGALA. And that's been kind of interesting to meet therapists who think out of the box there. So you can look, I think there are some therapists out there that are willing to look at doing things a little different. I think that Barbara Fidler's work and Matt Sullivan's and some of these folks that are getting more popular, are invaluable and very, very important. I do get a little concerned, and not from Barbara or Matthew, but about forgetting the one-size-fits-all approach to anything. I think we have to be very case-specific in all of these cases. We can have a working hypothesis in the back of our mind, but we have to be very, very cautious as we proceed through these. And a really good therapist in reunification does not really let all of their inner thoughts out in dealing with the cases. Because there have certainly been parents that I've had a hard time dealing with. And it's important to try to find a way to work with both the parents. That's all I can say. I can't say I'm always successful, but it's important to at least convey that level of respect to them.
So what kind of different variations do you get on your family workshops? Do you get families who are fairly healthy, who just want to be closer, or just beginning divorce families? Sounds like that would be a great time to get them.
I agree about the beginning divorce. Primarily, in the past, it was sort of, as I said, the end of the line cases. Now I am seeing more on the front end, which is nice. It is a little bit hard if you don't have court orders in place. It's almost best when the court orders are there to start. I'm also working with a foundation that is focusing on traumatic experiences. So whether it's after a family non-familial abduction or a traumatic event that the family has experienced, whatever the catastrophe is, or the traumatic event that has distanced the family members, we work with those families. So it could be even going through a very traumatic natural disaster, such as an earthquake, and, you know, maybe a sibling was lost, or whatever event it was that caused the disconnection.
So are there anybody doing anything like what you're doing in Illinois that you know of?
Not that I know of right now, but I think we ought to change that.
I think do too.
We need to continue to educate and get people out of their, you know, intellectual brain and a little bit more into their combination of the intellectual with the intuitive. Because these families, these kids frequently will show us what they need if we just slow down and listen enough.
Rebecca, where are there people like you other than in Illinois? Is there anybody else in the country that you know about that's doing any of this kind of therapy?
Well, I know that Matthew and Robin Deutsch and those folks are doing their Overcoming Barriers program, which they had a camp back in the East Coast in Vermont 2 years ago. I know they're actually going to be doing something quite near me, which I may help them out on for a 3-day weekend in the end of June. There's people like, I know you're familiar with Richard Warshak and Randy Rand.
Sure, yeah.
They do their very intense psychoeducational weekends. So as far as anyone that has as much fun doing what they're doing, I don't know. I'm working on it. I really am. That's why I said we're getting this manual off. I really want to, I feel like I'm a little bit coming out of the closet with this. Like when I was in graduate school, it was a little embarrassing to be the person that was talking about horses and things like that in class. And now I don't feel that way anymore.
Good. Will you travel, Rebecca? Will you go to someone?
I will. When I do that, obviously, I don't do it under the psychologist license. I do a purely psychoeducational 3-4-day workshop. There are good reasons to do that because, for example, I had a situation where the children's custody was California and the other parent lived in Colorado. And I actually did have a permission to speak publicly about this one, but I went with the least favored parent to Colorado, and we did a lot of the work actually in a hotel suite and then got out and about in the community. And really it was helping these guys untangle a really big knot that had been created by them, the parents, and also by the attorneys, and even by the judges somewhat. Interesting situation, too, because they had started in collaborative law. Mm-hmm. And the collaborative law had left too much wide open for these guys. And so this was 3 or 4 years after the adjudication the one parent was very upset, had lost touch totally with the children. That one was very rewarding because it went so well. I don't say that they all go that well.
When you do family workshops, do you ever get the grandparents involved?
Absolutely. And I absolutely notice the role of grandparents frequently in a lot of the cases, a lot of the situations. And sometimes, particularly out here, sometimes there can just be a downright cultural clash where you have a very, a more traditional grandmother with certain views that are maybe inadvertently adding to some of the difficulties. So, yes, I do like to get the grandparents in. Or even in the therapy here, I like to have grandparents come in. I think it's fabulous.
Well, you always have to have, if there's an alienation situation, you're going to have everybody that's backing up that alienator, aren't you? Because
yeah.
It's going to go right back to where it was after they leave there if everybody doesn't understand what just happened.
That's right. And it is interesting, too, how much the kids will acknowledge what's going on. And that is something I have to say puzzles me. Why I do have the experience of kids really acknowledging what is going on outside between the two parents and why that's often so hard for kids to say to some other therapist. This is my new conundrum, is trying to understand that. I had a recent situation where the kids just absolutely could spill exactly what was going on. They just didn't want to change their situation, but they knew exactly, what role their mother was doing and why she was doing it. Just very interesting. I don't know. It's just a question to ponder.
What do you think judges should do when children don't want to participate in therapy?
Well, I absolutely believe that you order reunification. You absolutely, this is where a lot of my colleagues disagree with me, but you absolutely, you consider it a normal thing that they have to continue to, they have to continue to meet with that parent. I think that the other parents should have some involvement in that work. Again, I'm contradicting myself because let's be very case specific. There are certainly some cases, and that's what makes this feel so frustrating to people that really like black and white. There are some situations where maybe that would be contraindicated, but I have never had a court case where the least favorite parent has been ordered to see the child that I have thought it was a good, for a good reason. Not for good reason, but a good reason to not have them together. Because the kid needs to learn skills to talk to the parent. And sometimes, in the case of estrangement, the parent really has pushed the child away.
Yeah.
The child, even if it's a young teen, needs to learn to find the words.
I think it's so hard, but what you're saying, a young teen and finding the words is so hard today, Rebecca, because mostly they sit with a little thing in their lap and text to one another across a table, you know, even their friends. And I think we've lost the art of communication. And when you heap this on top of it, how hard is it for a kid who has no communication skills to try to say what they feel?
Well, I 100% agree, and I don't even know that I should. Sometimes my mouth talks quicker than my brain. I don't even
Me
know
too.
Saying what they feel is really what I meant to say. To have the experience in the room with the parent, and sometimes as a therapist or my intern, even modeling the discussion with the parent, the least favorite parent, goes a long way. Because, you know, I've had certain kids in this office who don't say a word, who just sit there for the first X amount of sessions, just don't say anything. But, you know, I'll be talking and engaging with the other parent. As I said, sometimes looking at pictures of the relatives and things like that. But there's a modeling that you're doing. I don't let kids come in here and sit on the phone texting. But, you know what, come to think of it, I haven't had that opportunity. I haven't had that happen. I have had kids come in with their iPods on. One of my favorite was a recent one that we went down into the arena, and I asked the kid to take the iPod out of his chair, and he refused. And I thought, okay, I'm not going to get in a power struggle. So we were walking towards the horses, and so I said in a very loud voice, so you guys heard what I just whispered about the danger, right?
Oh. Okay.
And I couldn't believe it. We took the iPod out.
Pretty sneaky, Rebecca.
Yeah, it was good, though. And I let it go. I just didn't, you know, I didn't confront him. But I'll tell you, that kid did not have it in his ear in that arena again.
That's great.
So in closing, do you have anything you think that the judges and lawyers need to know from you?
Well, I think you can hear by my verboseness, if that is even a word, that, yeah, I think there's a lot that we need to hear. And the really, to simplify it, is do not in any way, shape, or manner minimize the importance of contact with both parents. And even if that contact is in an artificial venue, don't minimize it, because kids need to have the opportunity. I'm going to underscore safety, too. I mean, of course, you want safety. You don't want to have a kid in this situation. I'm not talking emotional safety. I'm talking physical safety. I like to say my physical safety is important, too. But I think judges need to hear this, that it is really important that families are encouraged to step to the plate somewhat and figure out solutions to the problem, too. Does that make sense?
Yes,
absolutely.
And one quick question. Alienated parents supervise visits better than no visits, true or false?
True.
Okay.
Good.
Absolutely true. Yes.
Can you give me your contact information?
Okay. I'm www.transitioningfamilies.com, and then I also have a Rebecca Bailey PhD.com. Website. The second one shows my humanness. The first one shows my humanness, so I don't know the difference between the two.
Well, you are a great human, and I have
you are.
So much tonight from you. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you
thank
so
you
much
so
for having
much,
me
and thank you, Jill. And Jill, have a good week. And you too, Dr. Bailey, Dr. Rebecca Bailey. This was wonderful. Thank you.
And I want to tell everybody, we've got Dr. Amy Baker in Chicago, June 30, 9 to 1. So watch Facebook, watch everything, details forthcoming. But, Rebecca, we'd like to get you out here.
I'd love to come out. So keep in touch. Hope to
All
talk
right.
to you guys soon. Thank you so much.
Thank
Take care.
You. Bye-bye.
Bye.